And even more worryingly is that this stuff is everywhere in the wastewater streams and it's getting into biosolids. And what do we do about that?
I am Reese Tisdale, and this is The Future of Water, in which we talk about all the ways in which companies, utilities, and people are addressing the challenges and, more importantly, opportunities in water. This is episode 62, and it's a good one. I'm pretty certain of that. I'm joined today by my colleagues Keith Hayes and Lauren Balsamo to discuss PFAS or emerging contaminants and how the problem is unfolding, whether it be in the US, Europe, Australia, and beyond. There have been varied approaches to tackling PFAS in all of these markets, and this includes, you know, regulatory policies being rolled out, whether it be regionally at the nation level, but also in even more local state markets as well. But without a doubt, truth be told, this is one of the top requests from Bluefield clients. What is happening in the what we would call PFAS market, and not just for water, but also wastewater and biosolids related to that? So there's a lot happening, lots of lawsuits, lots of policy changes, new technology rollouts. So what I'd like to do is bring in Lauren and Keith, and we'll talk about where the market is heading and kind of how will we get there, wherever that is. And hopefully that's good water quality, reliable water quality. But before we bring them in, what I would like to do is bring up a couple things. One, it's the end of the year at Bluefield, so be on the lookout for any discounts, deals, and opportunities to get some good high quality research. I'm not going to lie. We've got our CapEx and OpEx forecast report coming out, if not this week, at the very beginning of next. I know the data is already done. So year over year, state by state, province by province, includes Canada as well, report and data for anybody who's interested in that. Secondly, and equally important, Bluefield continues to grow. We are building out our European presence. For those of you who know, we've always had a presence in Barcelona. We have colleagues in Paris as well. But what we are now looking for is a sales associate in Europe to focus on the Europe region. If you're interested or know anybody who is, give us a shout. It's posted on our website. It's not that hard. Or just go to careers@bluefieldresearch.com. So, with those two high points being brought up and shared with you, what I'd like to do is jump on the journey, on the train to talk about PFAS. So let's bring in Keith and Lauren and get this conversation started. All right. I'm joined today by Keith Hayes and Lauren Balsamo, both colleagues of mine at Bluefield Research. Keith, long time no talk. How's it going?
It's going all right, Reese. Very busy. We got World Cup fever over here in Europe.
Well, we've got it at least in the U.S. for one more game.
Yes.
But, you know, we play the Netherlands, so I know our friend, shout out to our friend Marcel. We'll have to have maybe a beer over the game or something, although it's 10 in the morning. I'm sure he'd be happy about that. But it's exciting.
Yeah. We got Spain, Japan playing tonight, so all eyes on the game here.
Nice. So, Lauren, first time on the podcast. How are things with you?
Going pretty well. Yeah. And I'm excited to make my podcast debut. Been waiting for this moment.
Nice. Hanging on. So, well, thanks for taking the time. And, you know, for those not in the know, Keith is in Europe in Barcelona and Lauren is here in Boston. But, so one of the topics, well, I'll just call it the topic du jour, is PFAS and emerging contaminants. It's something that we at Bluefield have been looking at. We've put out a fair amount of research and data on that market, forecasted it this past year. But Lauren, you've been a key player in producing that research. You've looked at PFAS extensively and guided the clients through these reports, the forecast, policy analysis. And a big chunk of this has been focused largely on the U.S. Keith, in contrast, somewhat, while you look at the U.S. a fair amount, but your purview is a bit broader. You know, you're working with clients in Europe and other markets globally. And so as a result, there are a lot of questions that are coming about that. I mean, the U.S. seems to be somewhat of an epicenter when it comes to PFAS, but the net or umbrella when it comes to that regulatory wise seems to be expanding. So why don't we just start at a high level? Keith, we'll start with you and let's talk about, like, what do you see happening in the US market from your perspective through your conversations and your consulting engagements?
Yeah, I mean, the US, as we know, has definitely been trailblazing in terms of regulation, setting out, you know, federal guidelines, which have started to be adopted much more strictly on the state level. First, setting, you know, minimum or maximum concentration levels, and then starting to ignite this whole process towards identifying sites and then moving towards remediation, right? And that has led to, you know, the prohibition of using firefighting foams and trying to really cut down on PFAS concentrations in specific industrial sites. And, you know, that's been going on for the last 4 or 5 years. The US states have really started to step up. I can think of New Hampshire, Michigan come to mind as states that were on the forefront of that. And so now you're at a phase where, you know, it's starting to become much more part of the national conversation at the municipal level. There's been a lot more testing in the states about, you know, not just how to cut down on the effluent coming out of these industrial sites, but if it is impacting drinking water, how do you remediate that? And how do you do it in terms of advanced treatment systems on the drinking water side? And even more worryingly is that this stuff is everywhere in the wastewater streams and it's getting into biosolids. And what do we do about that? Not just how do you get it out, but then once you've concentrated it in a granular activated carbon bed or in ion exchange resin, what do you do with it then, right? How do you really get rid of this stuff? And for that reason, it's called, you know, the forever chemical. So for us, the US has, I think, took the lead on it. The EU has had regulations around this and also in Australia since 2013. Pretty loose though in terms of recommended maximum levels. And now the rubber is really starting to hit the road in Australia and the EU in terms of starting to monitor it and determine what are the safety levels and really try and ban the use of it at those military and industrial sites that the US has already done several years ago. So, you know, Lauren can talk more about the figures. I mean, we think it's a market that's worth about $500 million a year in 2022 in terms of spend on treatment technologies, mainly for drinking water. And about 2/3 of that is the US.
Yeah, I mean, the one question that came up the other day, and I think you touched upon this, and just to sort of put a bow around it, it's a little surprising to, I mean, I raised this in a team meeting the other day, a little surprising, you push back as far as like, it's surprising that the EU lags the US in terms of sort of where it is when it comes to PFAS and water quality. And I think you had a pretty good response to, you know, pushing back and say, well, actually, you know, X, Y, and Z. So why don't you, let's recapture the moment. And let me ask you that question. Why does the EU lag? Is that surprising to you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the reason we're talking about this, not because PFAS are bad, we've known that for a while, but we're really talking about the way the regulation works, right? And it's not easy to develop and approve and roll out and enforce a new regulation, either in drinking water quality or even in effluent regulations, right? And so that has to do with the urgency of the health risks. And a lot of that's had to do with where the PFAS have been most dangerous, which has been around these industrial and military sites. And in the US, you do have highly industrialized, contaminated states like Michigan, which has hundreds of sites that, you know, I think Lauren and I parsed through a lot of those and also other states that have just several different places where, you know, the concentrations are off the charts. And also the military base. I mean, there are hundreds of military bases in the US. They were using this stuff for decades. And, you know, those toxic PFAS-laden firefighting foams were of greater concern. I'd say it is a concern in Europe. Europe is clearly having these industrial sites. They do have as many military bases, but not quite as much. And so what that has meant is, I'd say the EU has probably gotten ahead on other types of regulation, like around micropollutants. So personal care and pharmaceutical products and like ibuprofen and pesticides and things like that. And it's focused more on trying to regulate that than PFAS, which I think they saw as something more isolated, perhaps less of a threat to drinking water. But, you know, the science still needs to do its job here in terms of studying the gravity of the problem in the EU. So, you know, I'd attribute it partly to just the regular priorities. The other thing is that in the EU, you know, the EU comes up with a directive, but then it takes years for it to get transposed into law at a member state level. And so for that, you know, there's just a slow moving process for this to actually come into force versus, you know, the EPA and then state EPAs, and then, you know, they start rolling that out more quickly.
Yeah, no, I think that's helpful. And I think your point about micropollutants is a good one. It's almost the inverse, right? I know we see, I think it's Switzerland is really proactive or far out on the curve when it comes to micropollutant management or regulations. Whereas in the US, we're still not there yet. And I know you've done actually over the past 5 or 6 years, a lot of work in that space. But Lauren, let's bring you into the conversation. I mean, because the US went back to PFAS, if it is in fact the epicenter, maybe sort of you could share some insights on sort of what that landscape looks like and what it means for the trajectory of global remediation. So why don't you shed some light on what's happening in the US?
Yeah, definitely. So the market for PFAS drinking water treatment in the US is growing robustly. And as Keith had talked about previously a little bit, this is largely just being driven by increasing regulatory action at both the federal level with the EPA, as well as Keith has said, state EPAs really just going out ahead and setting drinking water standards for these contaminants, as well as just there's a lot of expanding knowledge of contamination sites across the US, like Keith had said, the military sites, industrial sites, and landfills. And in our most recent PFAS forecast, we actually did project that over the 2022 to end of this decade forecast period, around $6.2 billion is going to be going towards PFAS remediation technologies. And it's growing at a very strong compound annual growth rate of 13.7%, which far outpaces the overall municipal sector growth.
Can I'll stop you there for a second, just to add perspective. I mean, I think a recent or upcoming forecast on CapEx and OpEx, I mean, those range anywhere from 2 to 4% in any given year. I mean, 4% would be pretty healthy for the US municipal market as a whole. So that 13.7% is pretty interesting. So sorry to cut you off there. Go ahead.
No worries. And really, this this high growth rate is being driven predominantly by this really ramp up in the US EPA's action towards targeting PFAS chemicals. So we do see that actually this month, we're in December, the EPA is expected to announce proposed MCLs or maximum contaminant levels for two of the most common PFAS, which are PFOA and PFOS. And the whole idea behind these is that I believe 2026 is when these MCLs are going to be going into effect. And this will be the first time that the EPA has ever set any sort of MCL for any of the PFAS compounds to date. So this is really propelling forth the remediation landscape. And in addition to just these federal actions, we do see that states have, as Keith has said, have been implementing their own maximum contaminant levels for one or more PFAS in drinking water. And I expect that the number of states to date is only going to continue to increase, especially as the US EPA takes their own regulatory action.
And so from what it seems, I mean, I think both of you, I don't know, Keith mentioned Michigan, New York, state New Hampshire, I think Maine is Maine on the list as well, of states that have implemented policies. Typically, are those state policies higher than what we're expected to see from the feds, or is it going to be the opposite? Will they be lower?
Yeah, I can shed some light on this. So when you look at state MCLs that have been implemented to date, you see about the ranges in the maximum contaminant levels range from about 10 parts per trillion to 20 parts per trillion. And if you take a step back to just get some perspective, In 2016, the EPA released their health advisory level, which is basically a non-regulatory threshold above which the EPA deems negative health effects can occur. And this was 70 parts per trillion, which all sounds like a lot of numbers, but still 10 into 20 is significantly lower than this 70 number. And based on just how this regulatory landscape has been evolving, I do think that the EPA will likely exhibit some similar trends when it comes to their own policymaking, and that these MCLs will fall around the 10 to 20 range as well, just based on the research that's been coming out and just these trajectories that all these other states have been taking.
Okay, so that's super helpful. And there are a couple factors. At the start, you were mentioning a $6.2 billion market through 2030, right? So that's, let's say, 8-year outlook, growing at a pretty healthy compound annual growth rate of 13.7. There are a couple factors that come into play. You mentioned a 2026 date or deadline for these new MCLs to be rolled out. So my first question is that factored into the forecast? And then secondly, is sort of a follow-up to that, at the same time, we've seen the Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act, which rolled out, which applies, I don't know, $10 or $15 billion towards PFAS. Are those two factors accounted for in the forecast? And, you know, is there a potential for delay? And sort of will that push it even further out?
Yeah, so our PFAS forecast is heavily influenced by these, let's call them bumps in EPA regulatory action. So we see in 2024 is when we will likely expect some systems will start to implement remediation technologies in order to get up ahead of these impending MCLs before they're really forced and have no choice but to remediate their water. And this would be following the finalization of the MCLs, which is expected in fall 2023, so a year from when these proposed ones are going to be expected. And then we do see another bump in 2026, which is when I had mentioned previously that these MCLs would go into effect. And then finally, 2028 is when there's an additional 2-year compliance period for some systems that can apply for eligibility to get their water to actually meet these MCLs. So these couple little bumps in just the whole regulatory landscape surrounding the MCLs implementation are key drivers in just expenditure throughout the 8-year forecast period.
I guess my question to jump in is, I think we're taking their word for it at this point. You know, we all know how regulation, I mean, Keith mentioned what happens in the EU. It takes years, decades for things to roll out. And part of that is, you know, deadlines get delayed. We're not even accounting for like impacts of COVID and who's going to pay for all of this. And maybe use that and jump into IIJ for a second. $10 billion towards PFAS?
Yes. So the IIJA is pretty significant in that it includes $10 billion for addressing PFAS contaminants in drinking water supplies, which is the first time any sort of funding has been put towards PFAS, as I said. And it is divided into three little primary categories. So $5 billion is specifically being designated to going towards disadvantaged communities and addressing PFAS. And these communities, $4 billion to help water utilities remove PFAS from their drinking water supplies, and then $1 billion to help wastewater utilities address these PFAS. And there's a big emphasis on helping disadvantaged communities address these PFAS, which goes along with the EPA's commitments that they made in their PFAS strategic roadmap, which was released in October of 2021. Because as we have seen, when it comes to these contamination sites, these sites like military facilities, landfills, are often in the vicinity of these disadvantaged communities. And as a result, they are bearing the brunt of this PFAS contamination.
Yeah. And I, you know, and Keith, I'll jump to you in a second. But one of the things about this rollout, I think there are a couple questions. The first is, defining what a disadvantaged community is does vary state by state at this level. And I think, you know, and that impacts state revolving fund allocations or awards, which is, I think, how these funds are being channeled to the cities, municipalities, and I guess utilities. I think that's, so my concern, if, you know, looking at it as a, I guess, outsider, is like, if the definition is not in place, then how can it be rolled out effectively? And so that there's concern for a lag and timeline there. The, in jumping over to you, Keith, one of the, Lauren brought up an interesting point. So you were looking at $5 billion to small and disadvantaged communities. We're looking at $4 billion to help utilities for drinking water. There's $1 billion to wastewater. And, every, you know, I know there obviously water, drinking water is paramount, right? I mean, of concerns in that we need reliable, safe drinking water. But the wastewater side, biosolid management side of things is incredibly complicated, and it's going to take a lot more than $1 billion. So what's your perspective, Keith, at least through your conversations, on what's happening on that end or backside of the equation?
Yeah, no, I mean, unfortunately, there isn't a whole lot of concrete action yet. So we're very much still sort of at the tip of the iceberg here in terms of understanding how big the problem is and how to deal with it. So what that means is that, you know, obviously it's being detected, PFAS in biosolids. A lot of these biosolids are still being applied to as fertilizer or are going to landfills. And so this stuff is out there. There isn't really a legal framework yet in place beyond sort of the R&D that's going on to understand, you know, the concentration levels. But it's true that, you know, this market could ultimately be as big or a lot bigger than drinking water, because essentially once we start looking at PFAS in biosolids, you could kind of end up sort of upending the whole way sludge management works, right? Where you're having to dewater, you're having to separate out the biosolids, you are shipping them somewhere, and then there are certain uses for it. And if that totally gets changed because of the cost going up of having to remove PFAS or not being able to dispose of those biosolids in the same place, that's a huge, huge elephant in the room, as I think one of our clients told us a few years ago, actually, when we did a breakfast briefing, I think, in Chicago at WEFTEC. And so, you know, there's obviously a lot of commercial interest in figuring out how to tackle it. Unfortunately, right now, there is a void in terms of regulation. And so, you know, I think what that means right now is, you know, we're going to try and stay ahead of the game here in terms of understanding, you know, what sort of research is going to start shaping some kind of policy around it. Do we start to see switching? You know, we've definitely seen some projects, a couple over here in Europe, definitely in the US, where they're trying to apply some new technologies, mainly I think through incineration is one of the ways to try and dispose of the PFAS. And, you know, over here in Europe, we've looked at countries with higher rates of biosolids incineration, like the Netherlands, which is, I think, incinerates about 40% of its biosolids. Potentially, if that's going to be the main option for PFAS destruction in biosolids, then, you know, that could be one of the markets that's going to be more attractive. But again, all of this is very premature. We don't know what's going to cost a lot if we're talking about incineration. Energy costs are very high right now. It's very hard to impose more regulation when an economy isn't on very firm footing, which in Europe, especially right now with energy costs, looming recession, nobody really wants to hear or talk about it. But that elephant is still hanging out in their room and, you know, banging against the walls.
Yeah, I mean, it. When you really start to sort of draw the diagram or the flow chart of in the cost inputs along the way, it really is incredible, right? You start thinking about, okay, what does it cost? You've already dealt with the drinking water side. Let's just take that assumption. On the wastewater side, you know, there's typically, like you said, their tipping fees, which are continuing to rise globally. Transportation costs are up. So tipping fees are up. But also, you know, another option that some of these utilities have been using is for fertilizer, depending on where they are. And so it can be reused. So that entire business model is under threat potentially, because if you're an off-taker for biosolids to use for fertilizer, and we've done analysis, we have a report on it, you know, then that model kind of potentially goes out the window, because you can't be spreading PFAS-laden, you know, fertilizer onto crops. Then it just continues the cycle. But then the other part of that is just the utility costs overall, trying to figure that out. And if it's incineration, you brought in the energy prices for incineration. Man, it's just really unpacking it gets really kind of crazy. So with that being said, maybe everybody's got their fingers crossed. And I know there are lots of discussions about technology will come and save the day. Let's look at it in two different ways. Quickly, let's go through the drinking water, because that seems pretty straightforward. And then we can talk a little bit about it, wastewater. So Lauren, why don't we start with you? So give us an idea of what the technology landscape looks like for PFAS management.
Yeah. So to date, the three main PFAS remediation technologies have been granular activated carbon, which is DAC, the use of ion exchange resins, as well as reverse osmosis membranes. And while these have been the three most predominant technologies to date, we will likely continue to see these technologies still remaining dominant in the sector. Utilities are used to using these technologies. They know their capabilities. They know how to design systems. And as a result, and especially ion exchange systems and reverse osmosis systems have shown significant capabilities in removing longer chain PFAS compounds, as well as some shorter chain compounds, and which overall just makes them good choices for addressing PFAS and drinking water.
And actually operators, they understand GAC, right? I mean, it's pretty straight. They've been using it for a long time for other things.
Right. So as a result, there really isn't a big put as because these technologies have shown success in removing the PFAS already, there really isn't any sort of big push to try and incorporate some other technology into existing systems. But on the other hand, as we kind of had gotten into previously, the wastewater side of things is where we're going to see an increase in these emerging, more advanced technologies that such as destruction technologies and like sequestration technologies that really can address these high concentrations of PFAS that we see in these concentrated wastewater streams.
Yeah, so I think that's kind of the challenge there. A couple of things. The MCLs, these regulatory limits, they're going down. So that basically, in a way, does that sort of partly, in some cases, push out GAC because GAC can't get down to those levels. That seems to be one of the challenges. The other side of it is by using GAC, you're also left with a waste product at the end of the day you have to dispose of. And so utilities are going to have to pay for disposal of the granular activated carbon if it's laden with PFAS. So that's going to be more costly, particularly if it has to go to a different type of landfill. Lots of factors in play there. But I mean, Keith, I don't know, you've been looking at this at the technology or vendor space as well. Let's talk a little bit about, like Lauren mentioned, sort of emerging technology. And I know in other conversations she's talked about, that's really where a lot of players are focused, is on the wastewater side of things. But what does the competitive landscape look like overall, like down the road? You've got some big players, the 800-pound gorillas of the industry, and then you've got the startups. I mean, is it going to remain that way? What do you think going forward?
Yeah, so I've sort of thought about the competitive landscape in three groups. One is all the engineering firms right now that are doing a lot of the preliminary work in terms of studying, you know, how bad is the concentration level in communities or around military industrial sites. They're very important right now because these engineering firms, and we work with a lot of them, obviously, in the U.S., they're the ones that are helping shape municipalities thinking about how do we deal with this, right? And they also act as gatekeepers, and they're very prescriptive in terms of what technologies they think would work, and they do their cost analysis. And I know we've done, you know, entire podcasts just about the engineering firms. They're a very important piece right now because I think they are helping shape the competitive space in which the technology is going to come into play, right? So I think those engineering firms, this could be very interesting business for them. And, you know, whether we're talking about Jacobs, Black & Veatch, Arcadis, all those big firms, more regional ones that we've worked with that have already started trying to figure out how to help communities deal with this. So I think they're all going to have some opportunities here. I don't think it's going to cause consolidation among them just around this one issue, but they are definitely going to be, I would say, key players and stakeholders for the technology firms. And then on the technology side, there's sort of two pieces here. One is like the more the tech startups, as you said. So the ones who have some sort of destruction technology, whether it's thermal hydrolysis or the supercritical water oxidation, a lot of acronyms that I don't even understand that probably Lauren knows better than I do. Those guys, you know, it's hard to scale up a completely new treatment technology. So, you know, they probably are going to come out of universities and entrepreneurs that have been working maybe some of the larger firms and get some reference projects and patent some ways to deal with this. And we'll see some innovation there. But yeah, I think in the long term, we're probably talking about that third group, which is sort of the big technology players that are that have been doing advanced treatment for a long time, whether it was Suez before or Veolia or Metawater or firms like that, that have, you know, a lot of experience with treatment, with scaling it, with doing acquisitions of some of these more niche technologies. But, you know, I think right now they're active, they're looking to partner. They're trying to understand what's going on. And obviously we're in the mix to try and help all these guys understand what's happening.
Yeah, I think, and there's a lot of, it's a lot of piloting, demonstration, a bit of a waiting game. Because at the end of the day, someone's got to pay for this. We'll save the legal landscape for another day, maybe, about the chemical companies being sued, you know, eight ways from Sunday for the responsibility or alleged responsibility for PFAS in our water and wastewater supplies. But yeah, it's really interesting. It'll be interesting to see how it unfolds. I know everybody's got a tight timeline today. So with that being said, I think this is really helpful. It'll also be interesting to see how things evolve, whether it be in Europe or Australia. We'll be continuing to monitor that as it unfolds. But guys, thanks a million for the time and the effort putting this all together. And it's December now, so we're in the last month of the year. So is for the listeners, before we got on this, there was a discussion about how busy things are. It's just that time of the year. It's a crunch. Not only do clients want things done by the end of the year so they can plan for next, a lot of that falls on us. So these are, for us, good problems to have. But if anybody has any questions, definitely when it comes to PFAS, Keith and Lauren are great resources for anybody. So guys, thanks a million, and enjoy the rest of the day wherever you are.
Alrighty, you too.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks, guys. Take care. All right, there you have it. So before we sign off, if you're in Boston, let us know. We can set up a meeting at our downtown location. We're only 10 minutes from the airport, 5 minutes from the train if you walk fast. And that's not just Amtrak, that's commuter, that's subway, all of the above. Please subscribe, give us a review on whatever podcast platform allows you to do so. If you have any questions, comments, or just thoughts about ideas that we should talk about, topics, send us a note at waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com. And lastly, tell a friend about it, you know, but don't tell my mother. She doesn't want to know that I have a podcast, or I don't want her to know that I don't have to hear about it from her. But that being said, this podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by the one and only Bluefield Research. To learn more about us, visit us at bluefieldresearch.com. Until we talk again, be well, be safe, and take care.